hottest for reporting episodes of hypoxia or decompression sickness. There were 14 reports, and that prompted the Air Combat Command commander to stand down.
The Air Force grounds F-22 fighter jets. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a potential fast track to help reduce climate warming.
In the Arctic, you could get, in some areas, you could get a degree of warming avoided just by tackling the measures we looked at.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The House and Senate this morning gave their final approvals to the negotiated operating budget for next fiscal year. The plan, as approved by a joint conference committee on Wednesday, spends a total of $9 billion, $5.7 billion of it in state general funds. Besides taking care of the day-to-day operations of state government, that spending also includes setting aside money for such things as this year's permanent fund dividends, providing funds for new state employee union contracts, saving $1 billion in the budget reserve, and substantially increasing the power cost equalization endowment. Conference Committee Chairman Bill Thomas of Haines said the differences between the House and Senate bills started with more than 280 items that had to be resolved.
Not everybody in this room got everything they wanted, and believe me, Mr. Speaker, we heard from a lot of people. But it was a lot of give and take, and right up to the end.
The budget passed with no opposition in the House and with only one vote against it in the Senate, as Minority Leader Charlie Huggins objected to cuts to the newly constructed Goose Creek Prison in his district. The budget only pays for interest on the loans, the cost of utilities, and basic security services. Huggins said the prison project was finished under budget and ahead of schedule, and he wants to see progress toward putting it into operation.
What we can't do is we can't validate the warranty on the prison to the extent that makes me comfortable. Because what we're doing is we're hiring a security firm to secure a prison, Mr. President. There's something wrong with that.
Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, who is a member of the House Finance Committee, pointed out that the budget only grew by about 4% over last year's, well within the framework of inflation and population growth. At the same time, he said there was a lot of money spent that will change people's lives. Scholarships, for example. He said it has been 4 years since the last input of money for students who need financial help. Meanwhile, money for students who show academic merit has been brought up.
It seems that today we've launched, hopefully, what looks like a permanent solution to that problem, so that the governor gets what he wants, which many of us want, which is a way for people to achieve financial assistance if they have worked hard in school and through his merit scholarship, but also for those who have worked hard who don't qualify for the merit scholarship based on their inability to pay. Money should never be a barrier to success.
The budget next goes to the governor for final action. Meanwhile, the legislature will return to the Capitol on Monday to continue to work out the final major issue of the special session, the Capitol Project's budget. The United Nations Environment Project is looking at a report that suggests a short-term fix for climate warming, controlling black carbon and ozone. The report says that unlike controlling carbon dioxide, which appears to be politically difficult and would take years to make a difference, dealing with black carbon would have an immediate effect on climate warming. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The lead author for the UNEP report, which came out late last year, is Dr. Drew Schindel, a senior climate scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Science Institute in New York. He says there's plenty of tried and true technology for controlling smoke, soot, and the gases that lead to atmospheric ozone like methane and carbon monoxide. And reducing them would immediately lead to a reduction in climate warming, particularly in the Arctic, where the average temperature has gone up 3 degrees Celsius, that's close to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, since the 1970s. Curbing black carbon and methane emissions could slow that temperature increase.
It's really quite substantial. You could reduce up to about two-thirds of the projected warming over the Arctic, so it's a really big chunk of the warming avoided.
The study points out that while carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere for decades, trapping heat by decreasing the amount of the globe it can radiate out, black carbon and ozone, which also trap heat, only circulate for a matter of days or weeks. That's why the benefit of controlling them is felt immediately.
And we saw in our report that in the Arctic you could get, you know, in some areas you could get a degree of warming avoided just by tackling the measures we looked at, black carbon and methane. So that's a pretty big change over the next few decades when, you know, try as you might, it takes a long time for CO2 changes to have an effect.
And there's already movement on this. Potential ways to control black carbon will soon be taken up by the same international body that dealt with the ozone hole and acid rain, the Convention on Long-Range Transboundary Air Pollution. Schindel says the control methods are well-known and proven and, for the most part, cost-effective. What's been lacking is the will to start using them.
You know, we know really quite well how to control black carbon. It's soot. And, you know, you put a particle filter on the engine or whatever it is that's emitting the soot, or you try to control how much, say, agricultural waste is burned. Instead of burning it, you plow it under. You know, these are pretty ready-made, off-the-shelf kind of either policy changes or technologies that have already been used widely around the world.
There are substantial industrial sources of methane and black carbon in the Canadian, Russian, and American Arctic. In many cases, controlling it would not be expensive. Schindel says the cost of better methane controls at oil and gas production facilities actually can pencil out to be a net gain. It's just that the gain is small.
Companies don't really bother sometimes because, you know, their methane operations and natural gas extraction and transport are such big operations that if it costs them $8 million in new equipment and they make 10, yeah, it's still not worth their trouble, even though it's a cost-effective solution.
Yes, in case you're wondering, the Prudhoe Bay oil production complex is a substantial source of methane and other gases, but there's no direct measurement. Some University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers in 1995 estimated Prudhoe Bay puts out 24,000 tons of methane a year. That's based on extrapolation from flights that took air samples. The state says only that BP and the other companies at Prudhoe Bay's air emissions are within the terms of their permits. I'm Steve Heimel.
Federal scientists say it looks as if there is a lot less oil in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska than they had earlier estimated. The U.S. Geological Survey bases this on both better geological information and the fact that exploratory wells are finding gas rather than oil. Its new report drops the recoverable oil estimate at NPRA to 500 million barrels, assuming a crude oil price of $90 per barrel. The last report back in 2003 estimated recoverable oil in a range between 5.9 and 13.2 billion barrels. The new report only counts the amount of oil that would be found in the process of drilling for natural gas, which is now estimated at 18 trillion cubic feet if the price were $8 per thousand cubic feet. The USGS gas estimate for NPRA is down slightly from that of 8 years ago. The Air Force has grounded its entire fleet of F-22 fighter jets because of concerns over the jet's oxygen supply system. Captain Jennifer Farou with the Air Combat Command at Virginia's Langley Air Force Base says the stand-down was ordered because of concerns over pilots reporting hypoxia or difficulty in breathing.
So the pilots were reporting episodes of hypoxia or decompression sickness, and after a period of time, there were 14 reports, and that prompted the Air Combat Command commander to stand down so that we can take a look at what's going on and find out what the problem is and what the best fix for that would be.
Last November, an F-22 that had taken off from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson crashed about 100 miles north of Anchorage. The pilot, Captain Jeffrey Haney, was killed. Captain Farou says it's not yet known if the oxygen system problems may have been the cause of the Alaska crash.
Well, the temporary stand down is a prudent measure that was following the recent reports of the potential oxygen system malfunctions, but it's inappropriate for us to comment on the F-22 crash in Alaska since the Accident Investigation Board has not concluded. So we cannot tie any of these issues into that crash because that crash is still under investigation and we don't know the results of that.
She says there are a total of 158 F-22 Raptors at bases in Alaska, Virginia, and New Mexico. The stand down was ordered May 3rd. It's not known how long the jets will be grounded. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans speak out on the redistricting process.
Both senators could work together and not be pitted against one another because of the two cities they represent.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Officials with Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson are reporting that a Richardson soldier was found dead in his family quarters on post early this morning by a supervisor who went to check on the soldier when he failed to report to work. The soldier was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 377th Parachute Field Artillery Regiment, 4th Airborne Brigade Combat Team there. The cause of death is unknown and is under investigation by Richardson's U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Detachment. The name of the soldiers being withheld until next of kin are notified. The state is responding to the first wildfires of the season. State Forestry put out a few fires in the Fairbanks area this week, including one sparked by a campfire and another by a burn pile. Fairbanks Area State Forestry Logistics Supervisor Arturo Frazaria says as soon as snow melts, dead vegetation offers a ready fuel.
The light grasses and light brush in the surface fuels. A lot of places the ground is still wet underneath those fuels, and the chance of a fire catching and really rolling are pretty slim this time of year, except on the surface. And then you can get a quick spreading grass fire.
Frazaria says the dry surface fuels are usually ignited by people complacent about spring fire risk. He says brush and debris burning is the most common source of early season fires.
A lot of people like to do yard burns or like to get rid of that pile of brush that they had from last winter or construction, doing land clearing, preparing for gardening. And they put up those piles, and sometimes they take off, and if you're not careful, they can get away on you.
Frazaria says the chance of low grass and brush fires will increase as things dry out up until green up. After that, he says the wildfire threat includes lightning-caused starts and fires that consume a full range of fuels, especially highly flammable black spruce. The state's redistricting board held the last of its statewide public hearings today. The board next goes into deliberations on a final redistricting plan. The board is redrawing the lines of the Alaska voting districts in accordance with the most recent census figures, and it has two options on the table. KSK's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Friday morning's testimony was reserved for alternative plans submitted by civic groups other than the board. Alternative plans have been submitted by the City of Anchorage, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, Alaskans for Fair Redistricting, and the Rights Coalition, among others. Friday afternoon's testimony came from members of the public statewide. Bert Cottle, Deputy Administrator for the City of Wasilla, wants to make sure the board does not put Wasilla and Palmer in the same Senate district.
And I know that has a domino effect as far as House members. If you would view Wasilla and Palmer as being county seats and not put us in the same Senate district, I think that would help in development. And then items of common interest, such as fire, schools, and roads, both senators could work together and not be pitted against one another because of the two cities they represent.
Elizabeth Gray, who is the assistant borough manager for the Matanuska Susitna Borough, said one of the board's plans carves up the borough too much.
For example, option one inexplicitly assigns Senate seat A to House Districts 1 and 2, which are separated by House District 5. Likewise, it appears as though in option one, House District 12 is extended up and out of the Mat-Su Borough for the sole purpose of adjoining House District 11 in Fairbanks so that Senate seat F may be assigned to both. Of the two plans, option one is clearly worse in that it results in three House districts with residents of the Mat-Su Borough joined with residents outside the borough, and it's not socioeconomically integrated with each other.
The board's two plans, as well as several of the alternative plans, aim to maintain the same number of Alaska Native influence or Alaska Native minority-majority districts that are currently on the state's voting map. But April Ferguson, vice president and a legal counsel for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, said changes in federal law and in population strength in many areas of Alaska require further analysis of what exactly determines a Native influence district.
However, the current districts were based on pre-2006 law as well as on an analysis of electoral behaviors in the Native districts. In other words, not only has the population changed, but so has the law and possibly electoral behavior as well. And the concept of an influence district is gone. The Department of Justice has stated in its guidelines, the Attorney General does not rely on any predetermined or fixed demographic percentages at any point in the assessment. Rather, in the department's view, this determination requires a functional analysis of the electoral behavior within the particular jurisdiction.
Ferguson told the board that its plans are based on fixed Native population percentages without adequate analysis. Ferguson requested that the board extend a public comment opportunity after analysis is complete. The board, by law, must come up with a final plan by mid-June. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The wolf hunting season is open a month longer than usual in parts of central and southern southeast this year because of concerns over low deer numbers. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says the season will remain open until May 31st. Petersburg wildlife biologist Rich Lowell says wolf predation is one of the reasons deer populations have declined in Game Management Unit 3 around Petersburg and Wrangell.
We've had three consecutive deep snow winters. In 2006 through 2008, we've got predation by wolves and black bears. We've got continued reductions in deer carrying capacity resulting from the harvest of productive old growth stands that are important for deer overwinter survival. We've got a lot of second growth stands that are entering stem exclusion. So there are a number of factors at play which have contributed to the low deer numbers that we're now having.
Lowell says the department's voluntary hunter survey shows the area's deer harvests have fallen well short of the state's objective for the past 6 years. He says the game board considered the longer wolf season as an alternative to more extensive efforts. Meanwhile, the state is also trying to get a better handle on deer harvest numbers. Starting this fall, hunters will be required to report their harvest after the season.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at PennAir.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at FullCircle.com.
A Yakutat High School senior will have her way paid to the college of her choice for all 4 years plus graduate school. Maka Montour was notified last month that she is to become a Gates Millennium Scholar. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
I st- I still don't believe today that I've gotten it yet. I'm still processing it.
That's perfectly understandable. The Gates Millennium Scholarship is hard to get your mind around. It all started in 1999 when Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda decided to set aside $1 billion to support the education of promising students of diverse ethnic backgrounds. African American, American Indian, and Alaska Native, Asian Pacific Islander, and Hispanic American. The program pays for all unmet need for its scholars, including graduate school in a variety of sciences, education, mathematics, or public health. 13,000 scholars have received funding from the Gates Millennium Foundation since its inception. 80% of them have gone on to graduate. Maka Montour joins the current crop of about 1,000 Millennium scholars. She says her family's financial situation had caused her to think about college in small pieces. Now, as a Millennium Scholar, the sky's the limit.
I can expand my horizons to even look into law school and to further and get the really sound, strong education I need to accomplish my dreams.
Those dreams are big. Montour has lived in Yakutat since 2000, where she's been active in basketball, cross-country, and cheerleading. Also a Tlingit dancer, Montour had been leaning toward a career in theater and performance. But at a memorial potlatch last fall in Klawak, Montour experienced an epiphany. She was asked to join the Klawak Native dancers to perform a piece called The Ancestors' Song. The symbolism and power of the moment altered her career plans.
We represented the trees of the forest, and behind us, Tlingit men in traditional warrior helmets and weapons wove through us to the crowd. And I opened my eyes and I saw to my right elders singing and to my left young children that weren't even as tall as my knees singing. And my own brother Kai Montour was in a helmet. And I just realized with the drum beating and the voices singing and tears absolutely streaming down my face that I needed to fight for this. I needed to have a career to fight to continue this.
That Maka Montour is particularly expressive for a young person is no accident. In her junior year, she began to compete in Alaska Native oratory. In the statewide competition, usually dominated by college students, she took first in storytelling and a first in dramatic declamation. This year, she took second in storytelling, but first in oratory, thereby earning a talking stick and her retirement from the competition. Montour credits her participation in Alaska Native oratory for much of her success.
An amazing experience. It really helps empower youth, Native American youth, to really speak out about issues and to really tell their side of the story and make a difference.
If you're hoping to catch Montour and congratulate her on winning a Millennium Scholarship, you'll have to wait, or pack. She's currently visiting Washington, D.C. on a school trip. Montour will graduate with the rest of Yakutat's senior class on May 18th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Although one doesn't receive the attention of greeting card companies or calendar notations, as KSKA's Len Anderson tells us, some people will observe Mother's Day on both Saturday and Sunday.
Tomorrow, Saturday, Carrie Blount of Anchorage will make her annual Facebook entry.
I thank my birth mother for doing the most selfless thing anyone can ever do, and that's give a child a chance at a life that you know you can't provide for them. I can only imagine how difficult that was for her.
Afterwards, Carrie, mom to four children, has a second birth Mother's Day tradition.
With my neighbor, because she has four children also, other than the child that she gave up for adoption. And so all of our kids get together and we just hang out, you know, and have a good time and talk about it.
When Carrie was 18, armed with her parents' support and Catholic Social Services records, she found and met her birth mother. Carrie says while the two have little contact, she is glad for what she learned about her adoption situation, as well as the discovery she has four younger siblings. Birth Mother Day is far from official. For that matter, it doesn't even have an agreed-upon day. An internet perusal shows some adoptees have selected the weekend before Mother's Day. Others like Carrie honored their birth mothers on the immediately preceding Saturday. The birth mother observance moves outside the traditional adoptions, where the birth mother and even the adoption might remain unknown to the child, or those situations where any relationship to the biological parents is severed. Susan Bomaleski, Executive Director of Catholic Social Services in Anchorage, accepts such situations. But when feasible, she sees advantages to the more open relationships.
What research has shown is that children that know that they were adopted and that their birth mother made a loving decision, a very courageous decision that she was unable to parent at that time, and she selected a home that she felt was able to parent, that it's more accepted, that it's easier for the child to understand than it is maybe they're a teenager and they find it out.
While open adoptions are regularly practiced among some Alaska Native groups, they are much less common among others. But there are exceptions. About 4 years ago, Victoria Salzman gave birth to a baby boy at an Anchorage hospital. Through Catholic Social Services, she had chosen a family with three older children who wanted to adopt. Victoria says although they missed the birth, shortly afterwards the hospital gave the new parents a room close by. Victoria says the four of them spent the next 3 days together. At that time, Victorious was battling a drug addiction that stemmed originally from a severe injury she suffered while in the military. Prescriptions were supplanted by street drugs and a lifestyle that would have likely condemned her son.
I know that he's with the family that he should be with.
As an adoptee, Carrie shares that feeling.
At least for me, I know I was raised by the family that was supposed to raise me. And I thank my birth mother for giving me that life.
Last Christmas, Victorious called and talked to her son. She learned about his newly unwrapped toys and made another discovery.
His mom told me that every night when he prays, that he also prays for his birth mom and his birth family.
Victorious, who has moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma to gain the support of her brother and other family members, along with Narcotics Anonymous, has been clean for nearly 2 years. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.